Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod. It's another Friday and another roundtable on the Bill Press Pod, where we invite three of Washington's top political reporters to look back at the big news stories of the week. And this week, like the week before and the week before that, there was really only one story: the coronavirus pandemic. How hard has it hit? How well are we dealing with it at the federal level and the state level? What's the economic impact as well as the human health impact? And how long before we see light at the end of the tunnel? Meanwhile, how did Congress suddenly come up with $2 trillion, by far the biggest spending bill of all time? And where does all that money go, and whom does it help? And whatever happened to the Democratic primary? Did it just disappear along with Joe Biden? Here on our online roundtable today, to make some sense of it all, Jason Dick, deputy editor of CQ Roll Call. Hello, Jason.
Good morning, Bill.
Thank you for being here. Eliza Collins, politics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Eliza.
Hi there.
Okay, and Chris Liu, senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and former deputy secretary of labor under President Obama. Mr. Secretary, hi, Chris.
Hi, Bill. Good to be on.
All right, good to have all you guys here. Just the latest numbers, according to Johns Hopkins University this morning, 85,800 cases of the coronavirus now in the United States, more cases in the United States than anywhere else in the world, more than China, more than Italy, and over 1,200 deaths, all in the light of what anybody at the White House will tell you, however, on the part of the administration, is, there are only two words to describe President Trump's response: bold and decisive. Here's a little montage of the people on stage with him every day at the White House briefings.
The president, again, took unprecedented actions. The president has really taken unprecedented action.
Thanks to the unprecedented actions President Trump has taken, bold, decisive actions the president has taken.
This has always been a bold president.
Mr. President, from early on, you took decisive action.
The president has taken such a bold and decisive action.
Decisive leadership in this unprecedented.
Strong action. It was bold. It was unprecedented action. Thank God he took that action.
So I salute you, sir. You've made my job easier, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Peter, very much.
Eliza, bold and decisive, two adjectives you would use?
I'm not quite sure. He was definitely slower than some of these other countries. In recent weeks, things did pick up pretty quickly, but for a long time, the president was insistent that this would just go away. I think there was a point in time when he said it would go away with warm weather in April. So he was not quite bold and decisive, at least in the beginning.
And Jason, maybe zigzagging might be a better word. Huh?
I was thinking that certainly the nation's governors would have a few different words to describe the way the president has reacted. He was on this conference call with the nation's governors and also D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who is basically a governor for all intents and purposes, yesterday. And, you know, he was talking about how, like, well, we're going to, you know, make sure that we're there for you, as you know, and so forth. And, you know, Jay Inslee in Washington, which has also been hit hard and so forth, people were saying, we actually need you to do a little bit more than just be a backup. You're the federal government. This is the most powerful country on earth. And, you know, you keep on talking about using the Defense Production Act to compel different industries to make protective, you know, personal protective gear and so forth. But you haven't done it. So that would be bold, is to invoke something like that. So again, I think the governors might have a little different reaction than the what's obviously a set of talking points that's been given out to everybody who dares to go near a podium at the White House.
And Chris Liu, fresh from Morning Joe this morning, good job. How would you rate the administration's response?
Well, President Trump gave himself a 10 out of 10. I would probably give him an incomplete or too soon to tell. You know, it's not bold and decisive. It's probably schizophrenic. I mean, he went 2 months with downplaying the outbreak. And then about 2 weeks ago, you know, I think took the appropriate tone and said this is a serious health crisis. People should start to social distance and limit gatherings. That lasted for about a couple of days. And then he kind of went back to his old playbook of attacking the media, attacking political enemies. And less than 2 weeks into this, he seems to have tired of it and now wants to reopen the country again.
Right. Now, we hear and we see the president every day. There were no briefings in the White House briefing room for over a year, as we know. Suddenly they're back, and not the press secretary, it's a president every single day for an hour or 2 hours. Day before yesterday, he said it's hard not to be happy with the job we're doing. I don't know how anybody could not be happy with the job we're doing. My question is, do we learn anything from these briefings, and should the networks be carrying them live? Who wants to jump in? Eliza?
I mean, I'm not going to comment on whether the network should carry them live or not. He is not alone up there. He is, you know, with these experts who do speak as well. Some people have said maybe just the experts have spoken, but he is the president. And to hear from the president every day, we are also seeing his approval rating at the highest it's been in a long time. So Americans are looking at what he's doing and appreciative of the fact that he's out in front of them every day, whether or not those briefings end up being a fight with a reporter or going through the facts. I mean, it seems like it's different every day.
It seems to me, Bill, so much of the debate has been, is this the 2020 version of 2016 and 2015, where, you know, the networks and particularly CNN and so forth gave him just so much unbridled time, free time, you know, to broadcast from his rallies and so
the
forth.
Rallies and
because it was but aside from the ratings, I mean, it cuts a little bit both ways, because again, we're at the kind of the beginning of this this process of trying to deal with this pandemic, and you know, if bodies start to pile up, as we are seeing, and I'm sorry to be so grim, and then the president is on air for an hour or two, and people begin to just solely, you know, identify him with people dying in the street and so forth, and you know, stacked up like cordwood in emergency rooms. I think you might probably see a scaling back of that just automatically, because that's one of those things where, you know, people just see him and they will identify him with this theoretically.
Yeah, Chris, just jumping in, and I want to get your response, but I have to say, like, so I've been to four of these briefings in the briefing room, and basically it's just happy talk for 2 hours, right? And the president says, we got this vaccine coming. Well, that's over a year away, we know. You know, we got these two new drugs, and Fauci says, no, this is going to be months before we know whether they work, right? And so it's not 2 hours, I guess I'm saying, of facts and data and information that's real or even true.
Yeah, you know, Eliza's point's an important one, which is the experts have a lot to offer, whether it's Dr. Fauci or even Vice President Pence. The only question is what do you do when the president is speaking during this period of time? And there's certainly, you know, he is the president. We are in a public health crisis. You certainly want to hear from the president. But if he's actually dispensing misinformation, different than what normally happens, but if he's actually dispensing information about drugs that you could take that would cure this that actually turn out to be wrong, you know, the networks do have a responsibility to do kind of a quick fact check on that. You know, and it's interesting because the argument's been made that these have become sort of glorified campaign rallies, which the networks have stopped covering along the way. But I do think Jason is right. I mean, it's not just the human lives, but it's also the economic damage. And the question is, how much of this does Trump want to continue to own if this continues to worsen?
And what's
right now? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what's different than a campaign rally is that there are reporters in the room asking him questions. So there is a level of accountability that a campaign rally just absolutely does not have.
Right. And what I find very is the stark difference sitting in the briefing room and hearing basically from the president, look, we're going to be fine. Everything's going great. We're better equipped and better prepared than any country on the planet. And then you turn around and you hear health professionals who are on the front lines giving their take about what's really happening. Here is Dr. Colleen Smith from Elmhurst Hospital in Queens.
From our perspective, everything is not fine. I don't have the support that I need and even just the materials that I need physically to take care of my patients. And it's America. And we're supposed to be a first world country. What's a little bit scary now is the patients that we're getting are much sicker. Many of the young people who are getting sick don't smoke. They're healthy. They have no comorbidities. They're just young, regular people between the ages of 30 and 50 who you would not expect to get this sick. I want people to know that this is bad. People are dying. We don't have the tools that we need in the emergency department and in the hospital to take care of them. And it's really hard.
And that's really grim, but that's the reality that's out there, Jason, right?
It is. And I think that, you know, the only thing that comes close to describing what we're in, particularly from the public, you know, like the way the public is dealing with it and how hospitals are dealing with it, is this is like a war. You know, the counties and universities and cities and so forth are starting to use sports facilities and convention centers and so forth to be set up as makeshift hospitals, not for treating the sickest people, but for treating the people who can be, you know, who have like less than a coronavirus or less than acute care that's needed. And I think as that imagery starts to sink in, people are going to understand that this is not just like a matter of being inconvenienced and trying to figure out how many ways you can organize your sock drawer. You know, I mean, like this is something that very few of us have ever dealt with. I mean, you really do have to go back to World War II and the Depression and the influenza epidemic, you know, to figure out like where we are in terms of the strain on the healthcare system.
Yeah. And I mean, I've talked to people in California, in Washington, in New York, in Washington State, New York. There, especially for the frontline public health workers, there are not enough tests. There are not enough masks. There are not enough gowns. It's very serious out there. And they're the ones on the front lines, Eliza.
Yeah. And we've seen that what we're hearing from the front lines is different than what we are hearing from the federal government. I mean, in the last 24 hours, the president questioned the number of ventilators that was requested, saying that he didn't actually think that they needed to have that many ventilators. So there's really a disconnect, and I'm not sure how that changes and if it is just sort of the really grim reality as this gets larger and affects more people, then it'll have to get up to the president and the federal government. I mean, we saw Boris Johnson in the UK has coronavirus now. Like, no one is safe from this. And so maybe as it spreads, there will be less of a disconnect just because of the horrible fact that more people know someone or have it themselves.
Chris, the contrast, I think, that we see every day. So we get the confusion, if you will, from the White House briefing. And then at 11 o'clock in the morning, Governor Andrew Cuomo from New York just lays out the facts, right? Here's how many beds we have. Here's how many beds we need. Here's how many masks we have. Here's how many we need. Quite a contrast. Cuomo's really, in my opinion, risen to the occasion.
Yeah, and I would actually add, you know, all of the other, well, I'll say there's a good number of governors that have really shown amazing leadership, whether it's Governor Inslee, Governor Newsom. Even Governor DeWine, who I think took action to shut down the state, you know, and it is it's the contrast between Cuomo and Trump, but it's also the contrast between what Cuomo's doing and what Governor DeSantis in Florida is not doing, notwithstanding the fact that cases and deaths are increasing in Florida as well. And so I think you see sort of this dichotomy right now between largely red states and blue states, but also between urban areas and non-urban areas. And I think the question is, as the president's approval ratings are inching up a bit, whether that's sustainable if this starts to spread to more red states, to more rural areas.
Right. Now the big question is, and apparently the big debate inside the White House, and we've heard this again from the president himself. Okay, look, we're two weeks into this. Enough already. Let's just forget about all this and get back to work. Reopen the country by Easter Sunday. Jonathan Swan reports this morning the president may be backing off that a little bit. And then I saw Andrew Cuomo the other day say that they expect the worst of this to hit New York, which is already the hottest spot in the country, 21 days from now. Let me just ask all three of you. Do you think it's realistic at all that by Easter we're going to be able to ease the restrictions on social distancing and stay at home?
I mean, certainly, this is Jason. I mean, certainly not by, like the standards of what we're seeing in a place like Italy or Washington State or Spain. They're struggling with where they go with restrictions now that they're starting to see this flattening of the curve. But I mean, the timing is just so crazy. I mean, to think that like on a religious holiday that you'd bring people out, I mean, as if we're all just like doing Lent right now, it's kind of insane. And also, Michael Gerson at the Washington Post is one of the people who has a very good sense of the pulse of like the interaction between religion and politics and national culture and so forth. And I think that, he was writing yesterday that there is just no way that the nation's like priests are going to endanger their parishioners, their flock. I mean, like that's just nuts to think that people in charge with like, taking care of a community are going to invite them in. And it seems like this almost like a made for TV thing. Like we'll come out of it at Easter, just in time to take advantage of all these sales on chocolate eggs.
And Eliza, this whole thing was maybe underscored by the lieutenant governor of Texas, who said, look, I'm 70 years old, but I'm ready to sacrifice my life, right? So the young people can get back to work, right?
Right. That didn't go over very well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there were a lot of people that said, I'm not quite ready to do that. There definitely is a divide. There are people who are saying, let's get this economy back because this is not just a health crisis, it's an economic crisis. But we're seeing even these experts surrounding the president saying that is not a good idea and saying so publicly. And like we're talking about, these priests and preachers not letting people come to their churches. At the next level, these governors we were just talking about, they're the ones who actually decide whether or not the states shut down. And none of them, Republican or Democrat that have been very active on this have said, let's just reopen things. So there might be this date that the president's talking about and he might announce that people are, it's open for business, but the reality is that it's very unlikely that everyone just walks out their front door and shows up at church that day.
Well, and
so Chris, go ahead, please.
I was going to add the other thing to layer on top of this is what the president suggested yesterday, which is that he might start making county by county determinations and relaxing social distancing standards in certain counties, which is just fraught with all kinds of, problems. I mean, certainly it disincentivizes people to do full testing. But it's also how many times do in a normal workday do each of us cross county lines and not actually understand where the county lines are? That's just not the way we operate in this country. And if one county opens its restaurants and shops, it's a safe bet that people from the other counties will flock there, which just causes it to spread even more. So it's, aspirationally trying to get the country back up and running makes a lot of sense, but it needs to be guided by the scientific and health experts.
And by the way, a week ago, none of us would have said, that it was not safe to go to New Orleans, right? I mean, this does move pretty fast. And I saw the mayor of Los Angeles yesterday, Eric Garcetti, say, we may not be New York like today, but that's what we're going to be like in 2 or 3 weeks, right? So you cannot say really safely, I think, that any area of the country is, let's say, green light, right, to go back to normal.
Well, just to put it in perspective, I'm a campaign reporter. 2.5 weeks ago, I was on the trail with Bernie Sanders at giant rallies. So things have moved so quickly. I mean, we were with thousands of people in some of these, in Detroit, you know, in some of these places that are now hotspots. And at the time, it was kind of this vague idea, you know, hand sanitizer, wash your hands. And now look at where we are.
Well, and we do know that the president gets some of his cues from Fox News, a lot of them. And he watches Fox and Friends, particularly, were he watching a couple of days ago, he would hear the urgency of why we have to get back to normal and reopen things from Ainsley Earhart, who puts things, first things first here, I guess. Here she is.
If you bought clothing before all of this happened, if you want to return it, are stores gonna you know, waive that 30-day period where you can get your money back if you need to return something? These are all the things. People are staying home. Women, I mean, y'all don't think about this, guys, but, in, you know, this is not a priority, but women have to get their hair done. Women, all my friends are saying, you know, this is not a priority. People are dying, and I realize that, but they can't get their nails done.
Oh, my. I think that sort of speaks for itself. We don't even have to comment about how ridiculous that is. But so, Chris, I want to ask you, there's been a lot of talk lately about a pandemic simulation that was done in the closing days of the Obama administration and presented to the incoming Trump administration. You were part of that. If you didn't, maybe you led that effort. Tell us about it, and would it have made any difference?
I think it would have made a huge difference. So a week before Inauguration Day, January 2017, the outgoing Obama team met with the incoming Trump team. And this is similar to a continuity exercise we did with the outgoing Bush people in January of 2009. And so it was a chance to walk through three scenarios that they would likely face. One was a hurricane, one was a cyber incident, and the third was a pandemic. It wasn't a chance for them to react and to do the tabletop exercise, but a chance for them to watch us do the exercise. So they could see how that when you're dealing with crises like this, you need a whole government approach, you need unified messaging, you need to respond quickly. And as part of that exercise, not only did we play act a scenario very similar to what we're having here, we also handed them a 69-page playbook, color-coded with all kinds of decision trees about how you should approach this. So the problem is sort of twofold. One is whether they listen to this or not, because a lot of work had gone into this. The second problem is of the 30 or so people that were there from the Trump team, only about 10 of them are still left. So two-thirds of the people have turned over. And you see that sort of broadly within the government now that you have, you know, no confirmed leadership at the top of DHS. You have a constant churn of employees throughout senior officials throughout the agencies that would react to this. So information was certainly provided to them. What they did with it is unclear.
Yeah, and nobody blames the Trump administration for the coronavirus. That might have made a difference, Eliza, right, if they had taken that warning seriously and at least filled the top positions for people who could deal with this crisis.
Of course, but I do think to Chris's point, like there's been so much turnover at that White House that they may have filled it all up in the very beginning, and most of those people may not be here anymore. And I will say, you know, a pandemic is something we have not seen in modern history. So of course, you know, people should be taking this seriously and be prepared, but I think it is a pretty unprecedented moment. So even the most prepared people would probably come up pretty confused in a situation like this.
We've a couple of times referenced that this is not only a public health crisis, it is a huge economic crisis. I don't know whether any of you had a chance yet to see the front page of the New York Times this morning. It's a page like we've never seen before. The entire lead column of the Times shows the spike in unemployment filings just last week of 3.3 million Americans. Jason?
I think one of the things that I, it just keeps coming up with me is that we have, we've basically, spiked the economy, downward in such radical degree. And the thing that is disturbing about this, I think, too, is just that there was no margin of error, it seems, for so many. I mean, I think we're really, this is becoming a very disturbing kind of fact of this, is that your favorite restaurant or just businesses that you don't really think about too much because they're always there, they're operating with such tiny margins that, like, within a week they could be basically out of business. And I think that that's, yeah, that's one of those very stark numbers that certainly the White House is probably, keeping them up late at night. But, not just for the president's reelection prospects, but just because what do we do with an economy like this where we're on just a razor's edge? And I feel like the broader thing, too, is just that I understand, like, the need. I would love to go back to work too, especially with a dead laptop I found this morning. I'm about as technically proficient as the wild cats in my alley. I think that people don't really deal all that well with ambiguity. Certainly, the president doesn't like to talk about ambiguous topics. He likes heroes and villains, and we're open for business or we're closed for business, and we're just dealing with a lot of ambiguity right now.
Chris, who are these 3.3 million people?
They're very likely, in this first wave, they're hourly workers. About 58% of workers in this country are hourly workers. So it's probably food service workers, retail, leisure, hospitality, that kind of those businesses that closed in the first wave. But what's important to understand is that these numbers are probably the tip of the iceberg, because the truth is a lot of the shelter in place rules in different states didn't take effect until this week. And so you're going to see this number spike up significantly in the next couple of weeks. And if this continues on, even large companies are going to have to think about how do we cut a salaried worker, higher wage workers. And that's going to have a whole second, third wave of impacts in this economy.
And to deal with this crisis, Liza, I know you want to jump in. Let's take a quick break. But to deal with this crisis, the Congress, at least the Senate, has passed the largest stimulus bill in our history by far. The House will be acting on it today. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back with our panel, Liza Collins, Jason Dick, and Chris Liu. It is the Bill Press Pod, and today's roundtable brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America. The good men and women of LIUNA, under the leadership of President Terry O'Sullivan, 500,000 strong, out there and building a new America, working on infrastructure, building new roads and bridges, active in the energy sector, not only building pipelines, but wind farms and solar farms. And as well as some 50,000 public employees, everything from healthcare workers to sanitation workers to mail handlers. We salute the members of the Laborers Union. Invite you to check out their website at LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A, LIUNA.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back with today's roundtable. Liza Collins from the Wall Street Journal, Jason Dick, CQ Roll Call, and Chris Liu from the Miller Center for the University of Virginia. The stimulus package, $2 trillion, 10% of the American GDP. Eliza, where'd all this money come from all of a sudden?
Well, it's certainly adding to the deficit that we've heard Republicans be concerned about for a very long time. But there really is, at least in the Senate, where it has passed so far, it passed 96-0. So there really was this appetite to just get some money back in there. You said it's 10% of the GDP. I mean, these numbers we're seeing, it's probably just going to start plugging holes. It's not going to drastically change things, but there was an appetite in the Senate to get things moving. This is an unprecedented size of the bill, and it's supposed to now go to the House today. But because of the way rules work in the House and voting needs to take place in person, they had hoped to get it done by a voice vote. And it's looking like that might not happen. So some lawmakers are rushing back to D.C. in an effort to try to make sure they have enough people to pass this bill, which, of course, puts them and their health in danger.
Right. So, Chris, who are the big winners here?
Well, I think I'll chalk it up at first as a win for bipartisanship. And I think it's a win for the American people. I mean, workers will get not only cash payments, but they'll also get expanded and extended unemployment insurance. Small businesses will get loans that some will be forgiven. So I think on those fronts, in putting some money into the U.S. economy quickly, that's a good thing. I'm a little bit more ambivalent about the corporate bailouts, although I think there's some important checks on that right now. But I think the broader issue is $2 trillion is kind of it's a head spinning number, but that might not even be enough given the economic hole we're about to go into.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Jason next. This is, I believe, the third stimulus bill.
That's correct, yeah.
And people are already talking about number four or number five. We might see even more.
That's right? Correct. And it's not just, you know, Nancy Pelosi these sort of caricatures from the right, you know, of people who are concerned that the Democrats are just going to use this to, turn us into a Soviet style state. I mean, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, someone who is up for re-election this year also, I would note, he said, you know, he classified this phase three as emergency relief, that this is going to take a long time and to dig out of. And, you know, Mitch McConnell can be practical when he wants. He's had the luxury of just pursuing his own agenda for the last couple of years. But he is in the sort of uncharted territory that we've talked about and realizes what kind of danger this is to the country. And so it's not just the Pelosi's of the world who are talking and the Bernie Sanders of the world who are talking about emergency relief for people. I mean, it's the, you know, if McConnell gets it, that is a sign.
So one final quick question about the Democratic primary. Remember, as Eliza pointed out 2.5 weeks ago, we're following every Tuesday, Super Tuesday 1, 2, and 3. And now, where is it? What happened to it? Chris, should Joe Biden be out there more than he is? The forgotten man up in Wilmington, Delaware?
Well, look, I think he is out there. I mean, you've seen these kind of video briefings he's done this week. You've also seen him sort of step it up. He did, I think, he did CNN, did MSNBC, did The View the other day. The challenge is you can't really do a typical campaign rally in this setting. You can't even do really a fundraiser in this setting. And so I think he's trying to get out there as much as he can, given the circumstances, but this is a challenge when we're in the middle of a public health crisis.
And Eliza, you've been on the road with Bernie Sanders, and there's no indication that Bernie's going to drop out. Or do you see
right.
any?
Well, no. And this morning he acknowledged that there in an interview in NPR that it was a very steep path, but basically said, given how unprecedented things are right now, that it's important that voters hear from them on these major topics. Sanders has given no indication he's dropping out, and his path is, as he said, very, very steep. He'd basically have to win more than 60% of the delegates going forward, which would mean he'd have to win every state by very significant margins. So not impossible, but very, very hard.
So Jason, what about the rest of the primaries and a pending debate in April? Is that going to happen?
I would doubt that the April debate's going to happen, and I think that we're going to see a series of sort of rolling postponements of the other primaries. I mean, we already saw several, that have moved to June. I just think that it's going to continue to be pushed into the summer and the late summer, and whether or not the party leaders want to hear this, who are planning the conventions. I mean, I seriously doubt we're going to see conventions in the way that we've experienced them in the last 20 years or so. I mean, I think that the DNC in July is certainly, I would really question whether that's going to happen.
Yeah, that's a very good point. If they postpone the Olympics, might very well see a postponement of the conventions as well.
Yep.
Eliza, thank you so much. Chris, thank you. And Jason, thank you so much. Now, we won't let you go. Before you share with us your favorite story of the week, maybe you were able to get away from all of this bad news, or maybe not. Eliza, you want to start us off?
Sure. I'm kind of cheating this week because it's not a written word, but yeah. I've been watching a documentary series called Tiger King, as I'm not sure a lot of people are talking about right now. And it's about the world of people who have big cats, tigers, lions.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely bonkers. There's just so many things, and it's a great way to get your mind off of all of this. So I'm cheating a little bit, but I would recommend it.
But you're not allowed to have exotic pets, cats as pets, are you?
Well, they're like zoos or animal rescues. It's not people at their house, it's a very, it's still a controversial thing.
Tiger King. We're all looking for TV shows to watch because we have a lot of time at home, right? How about you, Chris?
I'm going to have to stick back on the coronavirus theme. I'm thinking about a story that Nicholas Wu wrote for USA Today this week about Asian American lawmakers sound the alarm on coronavirus related discrimination.
Oh, yeah.
This all stems from the president calling these the Chinese virus. But what's striking about this story is that it interviews people like Ted Lieu and Tammy Duckworth and Grace Meng and ask them about what this means to them as Asian Americans, and it's the sense of distress, it's the sense that we don't belong in this country, we're others, and that's being espoused by that sentiment is coming from members of Congress, and that they're feeling distress about this, and it makes you wonder what other people in this country are feeling right now. So as an Asian American, while the president seems not to be using Chinese virus anymore, I give him no credit since he's the one that started this.
By the way, he was asked about that yesterday at the briefing, and he said, I haven't said it in a while, but yes, that's what it is. He just went double down right away, Chinese virus, and those words do matter. Jason.
Yes. I also, I can't quite get away from the virus, but it is a little bit better, a little nicer story, more local. The way that, you know, Jose Andres has conducted himself in this is just, and there was, so my, the Barracks Row fire department, like the engine over on Barracks Row, like they had gone out on a call a few days ago and then went to the grocery store, as they do, like usually after calls, to pick up dinner, and there was nothing there. So, you know, Andres like sprung into action, right? And and took a bunch of food over to it.
Gosh,
and
he's so,
you know,
great.
I mean, yeah. And I mean, like, that's a very small scale example of what he does. I mean, like, he is obviously, like, you know, doing this on a wider scale too. But to me, it's just like, right on, man.
And we'll never forget what he did in Puerto Rico. Which is certainly exemplary. Well, I'm going to stick to the coronavirus too for my favorite story. You know, we are all, we're sheltering at home, and you know, but we're craving connections for our friends. So I wanted to salute something that has really popped up now as very, very popular, which is the virtual happy hour. and it's happening with more and more here, more and more stories about it, where all you have to do is you decide if you want to be a host. You pick a platform, either Zoom or FaceTime or Skype or even Google Hangouts, and you will put invitations out to your friends. We're all going to meet on Zoom at such and such a time and bring a drink, and we're just going to just chat and talk and to see each other and hang out together online, which I think is a great concept. We on 8th Street here, not far from Barracks Row, have taken it one step further on a Friday evening. It started last Friday, where people just walk out their front door with a drink in hand and salute their neighbors. And the people across the street salute the people on this side of the street. Nobody was brave enough to cross the street, but at any rate, it takes a virtual hangout and the virtual happy hour just went even one step further. So, you know, God bless America, right? We all find ways to survive. And I encourage you all to host your own virtual happy hour tonight and every night of the week if you want to. Thanks so much to our panelists, Eliza Collins and Chris Liu and Jason Dick. And let me ask you to just indulge me a moment for a parting shot, which, again, are my comments and not necessarily the comments of the panel. As we have been talking here this morning, we Americans have been through crises before. We know how to do it. We pull together, help each other out, soldier through, and come out of the crisis stronger than before. And we do that partly because of our political leadership. Every crisis brings out the best in our leaders. Ronald Reagan after the Challenger tragedy, Bill Clinton at Oklahoma City, George W. Bush after September 11, and Barack Obama leading our grieving after the massacres at Sandy Hook and Mother Emanuel. The coronavirus epidemic has produced a leader also, somebody we can trust and have confidence in, somebody who leaves us with the feeling that while things are bad now and likely to get worse, in the end, we're going to be okay. Because he's on the job. The difference is, this time, we look for leadership not to the White House, but to the governor's office of New York State. We can't count on Donald Trump, but we can count on Andrew Cuomo. Every day, Donald Trump speaks from the White House, and Andrew Cuomo speaks from the governor's office. The contrast could not be more stark. Every day, Trump belittles the seriousness of the crisis, insisting this is not going to be, as he says, a rough patch. But every day, Andrew Cuomo just lays out the facts. Follow the data, he says, and urges people to take it seriously. Cuomo provides the leadership. Trump provides the bluster. Ironically, when Democrats were recruiting candidates for president last year, there was no mention of Andrew Cuomo. He wasn't on anybody's list. But now suddenly, some Democrats are having second thoughts. That's my parting shot for today. Again, thanks to our panel. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And the magic word again as we say goodbye is subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. If you haven't already done so, wherever you're listening to this podcast, pick up the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe. Thank you for joining us, and then tell your friends to do the same. With that, stay strong, stay safe, enjoy your virtual happy hour. Come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.